It's a lot of fun to come back and see Amanda after a few years. We were both a little few years younger back when. I had a great time teaching Williams, and I've had a great time since in Washington analyzing public policy questions, first income distribution questions, more recently taxes. And for the last 6 years with the Tax Policy Center, it's been fun to have my mouth unleashed. At CBO, I was never allowed to talk to the press except on background. Now when I finish talking to a reporter, I wonder whether I said something that's going to embarrass me if it shows up in print. Fortunately, if you're nice to the reporters, they're nice to you, and so far they haven't made me sound stupid. Tonight, I want to talk to you about fiscal cliffs, deficits, and 47%. And on the menu tonight, I'm going to talk about five things. Start off with budget history and the outlook. Where we are right now, where we're headed in terms of budgets. What taxes do we pay today? What taxes are there at the federal level? How do taxes work? I'll give you a little introduction to public finance at the tax level. And we'll talk about fiscal cliffs. Notice it's plural here. There's not one fiscal cliff. We'll have a whole bunch of them. And finally, if we have time, we'll get to the 47%, which is something I really enjoy talking about. I like the fact that it had a major impact on the most recent campaign. And I think it's a very interesting issue that it confused a lot of people, and I enjoy explaining why people are so confused about it. So let's start off with budget history and outlook. Setting the stage, a little budget history. Here is the last 50 years of federal budgets and the projections of 10 years going forward. These are CBO numbers as of last month. The blue represents the taxes we collect. The red represents the excess of spending over taxes, so the very top is typically spending. We actually had a couple of times when we had a surplus right here for a very brief period in the late 60s, and then in the Bill Clinton years at the tail end of the 1990s. But for the most part, we've been running these nice big deficits. Over the entire period, if you look at we've sort of averaged the revenue and spending over a 40-year period, average revenue has been about 17.9% of GDP, or 18%. Spending has been about 21%. So on average, we've been running about a 3% deficit year after year after year, building up that debt that everybody's worried about these days. The debt's gotten sometimes bigger. It was big back here in the 80s. It got very big with the recession. It's going to trend down, according to CBO, and if things trend out, we'll be down as a ratio. You're about 3%, 4% of GDP as the deficit going forward. I want to focus, though, instead on not on this whole thing, but let's get rid of the first 40 years, focus on the last 10 years, bring it down to manageable size here so you can actually see it. This is 10 years back and 10 years forward, and talk a little bit about where we are. The big deficits, of course, occurred during the Great Recession, 2008, 2009, when we're running deficits that were more than 10% of GDP. Our spending was above 25% of GDP, the highest we'd had any time since World War II. Our revenues were about 15% of GDP. The last time we saw revenues that low was about 1950. We're running huge deficits, in part because the economy was doing poorly, in part because we were spending a lot of money, the government was spending a lot of money, in part because people were paying low taxes because of the low tax rates we had, this tax stimulus. As that expires, things get better looking forward. And if you look out here, I'm sorry, back up. Look out here, things do get a lot better. What didn't we do? Well, we didn't do what we could have done, which was not pass the tax bill that was passed last month. This is the tax bill that was passed on January 1st, wee hours in the morning. Ruined my New Year's Day. Reporters started calling at 10 o'clock New Year's Day, and I was on the phone almost nonstop for the next 8 or 9 hours. And the next day, 36 reporters called me to talk about what ASTRA was going to do. But what you'll see here is if ATRA had not passed, we'd have a much smaller deficit here. This is the amount of revenue we would have gotten if we had not allowed taxes to stay low for most of the population. We would have been down in the next couple of years to a deficit of barely 1 or 2% of GDP. And even trending out here to the end, we'd be down no more than 3% of GDP. That's all very manageable in a growing economy. 3% of GDP and a 3% growth of the economy means that the deficit will not grow, the debt will not grow as a share of GDP. You can manage deficit over debt over time, but when we're running a bigger deficit, which we are, in fact, and will going forward, you're going to have much growing debt over time, and projected with this, we'll hit 70. We'll hit debt as a share of GDP approaching 100% by the end of the decade. This is actually the good news part of the story, because there are a couple of things that are almost certain to happen to make this a little bit worse. If we continue the spending growth we've been having, there'll be an additional spending. And if we extend the temporary cuts that Congress passes year after year after year to last for 1 year because we don't want them permanent, we'll pass them again next year because we don't want them to go away, but we don't want them to be permanent, so only 1 year, but we'll do it a year after year after year. These extenders have been going on forever. There are probably 3 or 4 dozen of them. They chew up, obviously, quite a bit of revenue. And as a result, our deficit out here by 2023, the end of the 10 years out, will be well over 5-6% of GDP, and that will push us well past 100% debt ratio very shortly. Again, this is the good news, because there's the bad news. Let's go out another 20 years. Spending's going to go up. Taxes will not keep track of it. Will not keep pace with it. And in fact, my graph has to be extended a little bit in order to pick this all up. I've got to extend the scale up from 25% top to 40%. The deficit by 2042, by CBO's long-run estimate, will be, what is it, 40% minus 18%, about 20% of GDP. That's twice as big as the biggest deficit we ran during the Great Recession. This is going to run debt up well past the 200% of GDP, obviously not sustainable. A couple of things about this. This assumes that we keep spending growth will continue as it does. Almost all of this is entitlements. The growth of health programs funded by the federal government, the growth of Social Security, both those kinds of programs unchecked will chew up an ever larger share of GDP. This also assumes that tax revenues do not rise. You see this as a nice flat line here for taxes at 18.5%. CBO makes that assumption because if you don't constrain taxes, you just let them go free for all, they will actually outpace spending. And by the time we get out to the end of this period, they'll be up close to 50% of GDP. How many people think that's likely that Congress would ever let that happen, or the population would ever let that happen? Taxes get to 50% of GDP. People are very unhappy right now when we're proceeding 18 or 19, 20%. Imagine what it would be if it went up there. CBO makes this assumption that over time, we haven't exceeded 18.5% of GDP with revenues very often. Highly unlikely to do that in the future. That's a good long-run assumption. But even if you let it trend upward, it'll still be very, very large, historically large deficits driving debt ever upward. So we've got a problem. The question is, what are we going to do about it? Well, let me start off by telling you about the tax we pay today. The biggest federal tax is the individual income tax. Nearly half of all taxes, about $1.1 trillion last year, were collected from the federal income tax. Another 35%, about a third of the revenue, $850 billion, comes from payroll taxes. Those are the taxes that support Social Security and support Medicare. They come out of every paycheck that you have. Social Security, you pay on the first $110,000, $113,000 this year, almost $114,000 this year. Medicare tax is open-ended. But last year, about 35% of taxes came out of the payroll. Another 9% comes from the corporate income tax. Those are taxes levied on large corporations. Not all businesses are taxed as corporations. Corporations actually, in many cases, have a choice of whether to be taxed as a corporation or to be taxed through the individual tax returns of the owners of the corporation. Smaller firms can do that. But the part that hits the big corporations delivers about $224 billion of tax last year. And we get about the same amount, another 9%, from the remaining tax of the state and gift taxes. They're actually both. Excise taxes, the tax we pay on alcohol, tobacco, firearms, got your guns. When you fly in an airplane, all the excise tax we have, and then tariffs, the taxes paid on imported goods. Altogether, that will total about $2.4 trillion last year. I find $1 trillion very hard numbers to get my head around. You know, trillion is a very big number, but if you put this back into individuals, $1 trillion is about $3.33 for everybody in the United States. But $2.4 trillion isn't that much. $1 billion of that. This is about 3,300 times 2.4, about $8,000 per person. It's about 15.8% of GDP. Again, that's very low by historical standards. The average we saw over the last 40 years was about 18% of GDP. We haven't gone below 15% ever in the last 50 years. And we saw it was going to trend upward. The United States is a very low tax jurisdiction, very low tax country compared to others. This ranks all the members of the OECD, the Organization for Economic and Community Development, Operation Development, OECD countries. The average for all OECD countries is about 34%, ranging from a low of Chile, which is barely 20%, to a high for the Scandinavian countries. Denmark is approaching 50%. The United States at 25%, this is combining both the 15%, 16% federal taxes and about 9 or 10% from state and local taxes, is very much at the low end of the distribution. But it's important to tell what we're spending those dollars on. The European countries down here at the bottom are providing a lot of things that we rely on private markets in the United States to provide. All healthcare, a lot of retirement, a lot of support for families with children is paid by the government. We leave that to individuals. Don't need as much taxes to do it, but again, we're a very low tax jurisdiction. So when people complain about how high our taxes are, I'd like to show them this graph. What do taxes do? A little public finance here. Obviously, the biggest thing is to raise revenue. But that's not all they do. They deliver social policy in a lot of different ways. We try to transfer income to individuals. Social Security does that. The supplemental security income transfers income to low-income people. That's a spending program. We use the child credits. We use the earned income tax credit, all ways to transfer income to low-income individuals. We encourage people to undertake certain activities. One of the things we do is we have tax breaks if you save for retirement. You put money in your savings account, in the tax favored retirement account, we give you a break on your taxes. We encourage you to buy a house by giving you a tax deduction for the mortgage interest you pay. We encourage you to give to charities by giving you a deduction for monies contributed to charitable activities. So we use the tax system to encourage people to do particular things. And on the other side of it, we use the tax system to discourage kinds of activities. Our taxes on cigarettes have been raised again and again in recent years, and that, in fact, does discourage smoking. We like to do that. We'd like to discourage people from polluting by imposing carbon taxes. We discourage people from drinking too much with alcohol taxes. Doesn't do a too good a job, I guess. In any case, we're not just trying to raise revenue, we're trying to deliver a lot of social policy to the tax system. What are the criteria for good tax policy? There are three things that economists talk about when they talk about what is a good tax. The biggest one you hear about, and the one that's easiest to measure, is efficiency. Efficiency to an economist means, are we allowing markets to work freely without interference? We want our taxes to interfere as little as possible with what people do. Taxes are going to influence people's behavior almost certainly, because people will say, if I've got a choice between doing two different things, one of which is taxed and one of which isn't taxed, I'm more likely to choose to do the untaxed one. We want taxes to be levied in a way that doesn't try to drive people's choices between types of activities, doesn't make people make this investment rather than that investment, unless, of course, we're trying to change people's behavior. Efficiency is an important thing, and we like to maximize the efficiency of a tax system. The best way to do that is to tax as much as possible at the lowest possible rates. If you tax as much as possible, then people can't avoid taxes by moving from one activity to another because you're taxing them all. So they're not changing people's behavior in terms of the kinds of activities they choose. And if you keep rates low, there's not much of an incentive to try to avoid the tax by either hiding income or doing things that'll make your taxable whatever's being taxed, smaller. So this is where we talk about broadening the tax base, taxing more stuff, lowering rates, taxing at a lower rate, And a lot of what you're hearing out of Washington these days is, are there ways that we can improve the efficiency of the tax system by lowering rates and taxing more stuff? Equally important, but harder to measure, harder to determine what's the right thing, is the question of equity, fairness. What's the fair amount of tax people should pay? There are people who say everybody should pay the same amount of tax. Not very many. There are other people who say we should all pay the same share of our income in tax. There are other people who say it's most important to measure the ability to pay. How much do you have after basic expenses? How much do you have that we could tax, and we should tax some portion of that? We have a very progressive tax system in the United States. Some pieces of it are more progressive than others. Progressive tax system is one in which the more you make, the larger share of that we take. The less you make, the smaller share. And we'll see in a few minutes as I show some of the graphs I've got about the equity of the system we've got, the income tax system. And the final thing we care about, but you wouldn't know it by looking at our tax system, is simplicity. We'd like to have a simple tax system so it's A, inexpensive for people to comply with, and B, easy to comply with. It's not hard to figure out what your taxes are. You see congressmen all the time coming with these big stacks of books. You know, here's 2,000 pages of tax regulations. Most of those regulations are trying to figure out how big your income is in terms of taxes. It has nothing to do with the taxes we levy on that income. It has to figure out what income is. And most of that's for businesses, by the way, not individuals. We certainly don't have a simple tax system. That's shown by the fact that 90% of us don't do our own taxes, pen and paper, and fill out the returns ourselves. 60 to 65% of us hire somebody to do the job for us. We go to H&R Block or our favorite accountant, get them to work it out. Another 25 or 30% of us buy computer software, do our taxes online, let the software take care of it for us. The problem with that is if you don't do your own taxes, you have somebody else do it for you, if it's so complicated, you don't understand how taxes are working, you can't understand the tax system. And you think, as most people do, it is so complicated, people must be getting away with murder in the system. They know things to do in this complicated tax system, ways to save on taxes, that I'm not figuring out. Something's wrong with this system. And that it creates a lot of distrust and actually can lead to people cheating on their income tax. Despite the fact that a poll the other day showed 90% of people thought you should never lie on your income tax, never cheat on your income tax, in fact, there's a lot more cheating than that. We estimate that about $300 billion a year in taxes that should be collected is not collected because of different forms of not complying. Part of that's because people can get away with it, it's kind of a complicated system. Part of it is just because we have an inefficient system where it changes people's behavior, gives them incentives to change the amount of taxes they're paying. By the way, interrupting with questions along the way, I will talk all night long. I think, am I talking slow enough, Jane? My wife told me I should talk more slowly than I usually do, so I'm trying to keep my tempo down. Okay, so those are the things we want to do. It's hard to measure this. Let me talk a little bit more about equity. A key thing with equity is measuring who actually pays taxes. And you'd say, that's obvious. You know, corporations pay taxes. They're the ones that pay the corporate income tax. Workers pay payroll taxes. Individuals pay their income taxes. Who pays the estate tax? Well, that's a good question. We'll talk about that in a moment. Who actually pays is a lot harder question to answer. The payroll tax, for example. For Social Security, each worker pays 6.2% of the first $113,700 of income this year. And their employers pay the same amount. Sounds like there's a tax on workers and there's a tax on businesses. Virtually every economist will tell you, no, that's not true. In fact, the worker is being paid 6.2%, roughly, less because of that tax. And in fact, the tax is coming out of the pay he otherwise would get. So in fact, the full 12.4% for Social Security is coming out of the worker side, and nothing is being paid by the corporation. So we'll assign the incidence who actually pays that payroll tax to the worker. The same is true of the Medicare tax. How about the corporate income tax? Well, there's three possibilities for the corporate income tax. It could be paid by corporations, the owners of corporations, in the form of a lower return after tax. They've invested in the companies. They're getting money back either in dividends or capital gains. they could be getting a lower return because that corporation has to pay taxes. Alternatively, the corporation could be paying workers less than they otherwise would pay them. If the taxes weren't in place, the corporation could invest in more capital, could make workers more productive. Workers would have higher productivity and therefore higher pay, so the tax is coming out of their hides. Or it's possible that they're passing some of the tax on to consumers in the form of higher prices on their goods. There's a lot of disagreement among economists on that instance, the question of who pays the corporate income tax. Some people argue that more than all of the tax is paid by workers, believe it or not. There's a study by CBO that says 70% of the tax is paid by workers, and almost all the value goes to foreign workers because instead of investment in the United States, investment goes abroad, makes foreign workers more productive because they're the ones with more capital to work with. American workers have less, so the American workers are earning less. Our assumption, our conclusion at this point is about 20% of the tax is paid by workers in the form of lower wages, and the other 80% by corporations, and split up in a way that's kind of hard to describe. Talk about two different kinds of equity, vertical equity and momentarily horizontal equity. Vertical equity says, how do we compare up and down the income scale? Do higher income people pay more? How much more do they pay? Is there fairness going up and down the income scale when you compare people with different incomes? In contrast, we have horizontal equity. We're trying to compare people with equal incomes and say, are they paying the same taxes? Example I use for that is LeBron James and Warren Buffett. LeBron James, you know, makes his income by bouncing a basketball and selling shoes. He gets a lot of money. It's all wages. So he's being taxed at the ordinary tax rates, which go as high as 39.6%, and then a little bit more on top of that. Warren Buffett, on the other hand, makes his money from investment. He buys corporations. He makes them into better corporations. He gets income from those corporations. His income is mostly dividends and capital gains, all of which are taxed now at a maximum tax rate of 20%, plus a little bit more. They have incomes that are not terribly different, yet Warren Buffett pays a lot lower tax than LeBron James. That's a question of horizontal equity. Is that fair or not? But you could argue it is fair if the money that Warren Buffett's getting has been taxed elsewhere. The money he's getting with corporations may have been taxed through corporate taxes, and therefore he's getting less than he otherwise would get, and he's in fact paying more tax than it appears just by looking at the income tax. Or he could say, no, that's not, the tax is really shared differently there. So horizontal equity, measuring across, vertical equity, measuring up and down. We'll take a look at vertical equity. Horizontal equity is really hard to work with because it's hard to say who is equivalent. Is a family with a married couple with two kids and $50,000 income equivalent to a single person with $50,000 of income? Now they both have $50,000 of income, and in one sense, they are horizontally equal. But in terms of their needs, the four people sharing $50,000 of income, quite different from one person with $50,000 of income. Measuring horizontal equity, are they the same, is hard. What is equal? What is horizontally equal? And measuring what the taxes should be. And then even not measuring what the incidence of the taxes is. Vertical equity tends to be a little easier, but still you've got a question of how do you rank people in terms of who's better off, who's worse off, who's higher in the income scale. We're talking about PowerPoint at dinner and saying not too many words on PowerPoint. Is that few enough for you? Incomes and tax are distributed unequally. In 2013, this year, we estimate that about half of all income will be earned by people in the top income quintile. Quintiles are fifths of the distribution, 20% chunks of the distribution. So the lowest quintile is the poorest 20%, those with the lowest incomes. The highest quintile is those that are in the top 20%. The 20% of people with the highest incomes earn slightly more than half of all income this year. In contrast, those in the bottom end, the lowest, only about 4% of income. As unequal as that is, taxes are even more so because those rich guys are paying about two-thirds of all federal taxes. And the poor guys are paying so little you can't even see their slice here. It's about 0.4% of all taxes. They're earning about 4% of the income and paying 0.4% of tax. The rich guys are earning half the income and paying about two-thirds of the taxes. That's a progressive tax system. The more you make, the more you're paying as a share of your income. Here's another way to look at it. I've again put the five quintiles now across the bottom of the bar for each one. Vertically, the entire bar measures your total income before taxes. So at the bottom end, the lowest income quintile has before tax income of about $10,000. People in the top quintile have incomes on average about $250,000 before taxes. The red is the amount of federal tax paid by people in each income segment. So at the very bottom, only 1.8% of income is going to federal taxes, leaving them with not very much different income from the $10,000 they started off with. Contrast at the very top, 27.5% of income is going for federal taxes, leaving them with substantially less. But no, there's still, even after taxes, a very, very unequal distribution of post-tax income, the blue bars. If we go further up the income distribution, let's take this top income quintile and break it up into smaller pieces. And you'll notice I had to change the vertical scale here. The top now is back here. It was, oops, sorry. Back here is only $250,000. Well, now we have to go to $8 million to get the average income for the top 0.1%. So I've got the 80th to 90th percentile, the 90th, 95th, the 95th to 99th. These guys all sort of disappear on this big scale because to be in the up to the 80th percentile, you have to make a little more than $100,000. If the 90th percentile, about $180,000. To make it the top 1/10 of one, top 1%, you need to make about $600,000. More than $600,000, your pre-tax income is approaching $1.7 million. And to get to the top end, you have to have about $2.2 million in income to make it into the category. On average, those people have almost $8 million of income this year. And you'll note that even at the very top, taxes are very progressive. Since the 90th percentile are only paying 20% of their income in taxes, people in the top 1% on average are paying 36%, and people at the very top are paying 38%. Still, though, after taxes, very, very, very unequal distribution of income at the very top. This has changed a lot in recent years. If you go back over the last 30 years, the income at the top of the income distribution has grown remarkably fast. Income through the rest of the income distribution has grown much more slowly. Up until a couple of years ago, almost all the income gain was going to the top end. If you looked at the change in income after adjusting for inflation and changes in family size and so forth, from 1979 through 2005, people in the bottom quintile saw their real incomes go up by 1%. People in the middle quintile saw their incomes go up by 15%. People in the top quintile, the top 20%, saw their incomes go up by 90%. And people in the top 1% saw their incomes go up by a factor of 3. They tripled. So bottom end, 1% increase, middle 15%, top 1%, 300% increase in tax in income. At the same time, tax rates went down for everybody, but went down more at the top end. That's exactly why President Obama has argued since he started running for president in 2007 that we need to tax the high income more, because they're the ones that have done very well in recent years. They're the ones that have the ability to pay more tax. The rest of the income distribution doesn't have that ability to pay. Things were somewhat different over the last few years. The Great Recession hit people very hard. One thing that the IRS comes out with every year is a look at the top 400 taxpayers. Those guys took a real hit in the recession. Their incomes dropped by about $90 million each on average. Almost all of that was taking smaller capital gains. They get about a substantial per share of their income. About 2/3 of their income comes from capital gains, which is receives favored tax treatment. But those people, very volatile incomes. This picture wouldn't show if I were doing it for the middle of the recession. Here's another way to look at it. Here, what I want to do is break out the different kinds of taxes. I've got four different kinds of taxes listed across the bottom. The dark blue is the individual income tax, the tax we all file on April 15th. The red are the payroll taxes for those that fund Social Security and Medicare. The light blue is the corporate income tax, and the red is the estate tax, or the pink. At the very bottom of the income distribution, you'll see the income tax, the blue, is negative. People in the very bottom quintile are paying about minus 7% of their income in taxes. That is, they're getting payments from the government, augmenting their income by about 7% of what they're getting from market income. They're paying payroll taxes that are bigger than that, and their share of the corporate tax is enough to bring them to the 1.8% we saw in the last draft. By the time you get to the middle quintile, income taxes are now positive, and they grow very rapidly as a share of income. These percentages by up here are income taxes, what, about 26% of income. Income tax, very progressive. In contrast, payroll taxes, the red bars, get smaller as you get to the top. That's because we don't tax all income. We don't tax, for Medicare purposes, all earnings. And we don't impose any of these taxes on unearned income, on investment income. So at the top end, where people are getting a lot of investment income and much of their earnings are not subject to Social Security taxes, only that first $113,700 is subject to tax, their share of income going to the payroll tax is very small. This is about, 2%, well, less than 2%. Light blue, the corporate income tax, you'll see grows. Again, this is a function of the fact that much of the tax is paid by investors and in form of lower returns. So much of that tax is being paid by people at the top end of the distribution. And the estate tax is only paid by people at the top end. There's nothing paid below the 95th percentile. The pink here is because of these rich guys. And it's meaningful over here up at the top. One question to toss at you. Watch the time here. Well, one question to ask has to do with who pays the estate tax? There are two possibilities. The estate tax could be paid by the person who dies because he has less to leave after taxes. Or it could be borne by people who are inheriting the tax, inheriting from the estate from the individual. Most people argue that it depends on the purpose for leaving an estate. If you left it accidentally, I just died too soon before I could use up all that I had, then the tax falls on the person dying because he didn't use all that money. If you view it as I'm giving money to these kids because they need it, I'm trying to transferring it to them, making them better off, then you can argue that they're the ones who are suffering the cost. But I think most economists argue that the cost is imposed on the decedent, and that's what we do here in signing these. Okay. Let's talk about how we do our income taxes. I don't know how many of you recognize any of these forms. Many people don't have to fill them out. If you miss any of them, I've got on my tie tonight. This is my favorite tie for giving talks about taxes. It's pieces of tax returns. But I want to simplify away from this to a lot. I want to start by saying, how do we impose taxes on income? Let's start off with all income. I'm going to break it into three pieces. First is earnings. Earnings get hit by two kinds of taxes. You pay the income tax, you pay payroll tax. Another big chunk of income is capital gains and dividends. We tax that only through the income tax, but we tax it at lower rates, preferential rates, no higher than 20%. The income tax on earnings can be as high as 39.6%. And then the rest of your income gets hit only by the income tax. How does the individual income tax work? Well, we start off with all income, but there's a big chunk of that we're not going to tax at all. We first allow you not to count, not to report, not to tell us how much income you got from a number of different sources. For example, if you earn income as interest on municipal bonds, the bonds that cities and float in order to fund capital investments, you don't have to pay tax on the interest paid on those bonds. If you get Social Security, at least 15% of your Social Security benefits are exempt from tax. And if you're low income, 100% of your Social Security is exempt from tax. If you take a job overseas, hint for you guys about to graduate, jobs overseas, good thing, because the first $90,000 you earn is not subject to federal income tax. Earn that money, bring it home tax-free. Overall, we exclude a total of 18% of all income because of these various rules that say you don't have to count the income. We also allow exemptions. Every person reported on your tax return, you, your spouse, your dependents, gets an exemption of $3,900. So if you're a married couple with three kids, that knocks $19,500 off your taxable income. You don't have to pay taxes on it. That, in total, is about 11% of all income. not subject to tax. And then we allow deductions. You can either take the standard deduction, a fixed amount for a tax return, $6,000 roughly per individual, $12,000 if you're a married couple filing a joint return. Or, if you choose, you can itemize your deductions and say, there's certain things I'm allowed to count as deductions reduce my income. Things, the biggest ones, well, we'll talk about the biggest ones in a few minutes, but the ones that show up most obviously, taxes you pay to state and local governments, interest you pay on your mortgage, money you give to charities. You give money to Swarthmore, again, seniors on your way out the door, give money to, a lot of money, enough to, so you can deduct it, makes it sense to itemize. If you have enough of these itemized deductions to make it more than your standard deduction, you want to itemize, reducing your income subject to tax. And again, that adds up to about 15%. So overall, we're left with only 57% of the income subject to tax, and 43% doesn't see the federal income tax at all. We then apply an appropriate tax rate. Appropriate depends on the kind of income it is, to your taxable income, and that gives you a measure of your tax before we give you any tax credits. And then we allow you to subtract off credits to get the income tax you pay. Tax credits differ from the reductions in income in that they reduce your tax bill directly. A $1 credit reduces your tax bill by a dollar. A tax deduction reduces the income subject to tax by a dollar, but that saves you taxes only based on the share of that paid in taxes. So if you're paying a 15% tax rate, that dollar reduction is worth 15 cents. Contrast, a dollar credit is worth a dollar reduction in your taxes. Big credits here, the child tax credit, $1,000 per child under age 17. Another one is the earned income tax credit. If you're a low-income worker, you get a subsidy from the government equal to as much as 45% of the first $8,000 or $9,000 of income that you earn. A boost in income for low-income workers, encouraging them to go to work, encouraging them to work more. There's a credit for having child care, dependent care, so you can go to work. You can deduct up to $6,000 for two children, $3,000 for one child, and you get a tax credit equal to as much as 35% of that. I think that's the right number. Put all these together, we've got five ways in which taxes are reduced, what we call tax expenditures, spending through the tax system by allowing you to reduce your taxes for various activities, exclusions, exemptions, deductions, credits, preferential tax rates. These are the biggest tax expenditures as measured by the Joint Committee on Taxation, the Congress's taxing committee. Talk about a few of these very quickly. I'm going to run out of time if I don't talk faster. The biggest one is exclusion of employer health insurance contributions. This is the one that 60% of us get our health insurance through our employers or through somebody in our family's employer. The cost of that insurance is not subject to income tax. You get that tax-free. And that's a lot of money. For a family, the plan will cost somewhere on the order of $15,000. For an individual, it can be anywhere between $5,000 and $8,000. Income not subject to tax. That reduces revenue by an average of about $200 billion a year over the next 5 years. Other big ones, not taxing benefits on employer-sponsored retirement plans. If I contribute to a retirement plan, I don't pay tax on that income until I draw it out. Here's that deduction for home mortgage interest. If I pay mortgage interest on my mortgage, I don't have to pay tax on that. That's one of my bugaboos. I hate that one. Let me describe a quick spending program I propose to help encourage people to buy homes. I'm going to offer the following deal. If you're a person who's relatively low moderate income, I'm going to pay 10, maybe 15% of your mortgage interest. But if you're a rich guy, you know, you have the big house to buy. It's expensive. I'm going to pay 35% of your mortgage interest if you're a rich guy. Think that's a good idea? 35% subsidy for the rich guy. I'm sorry, make it 39.6 now. Sorry. 10 or 15% subsidy for the poor guy. That's exactly how our mortgage interest works because rich people, a dollar deducted, saves them 39.6 cents in taxes. The poor guy in the 10 or 15% tax bracket saves only 10 or 15 cents. So we're subsidizing rich people to buy big houses a lot more than we're subsidizing low and middle income families to buy more moderate houses. Crazy way to spend our money. We're going to likely get out from under that. Good luck with that. The real estate industry fights tooth and nail for this one, but it's $120 billion a year that we're not collecting in revenue. And by the way, it doesn't increase the rate of home ownership. There's no evidence that allowing people to deduct their mortgage interest makes them more likely to buy a home. What it does, it makes them more likely to pay more money for a home and buy a bigger home. But to buy a home in the first place, there's no evidence that this encourages home ownership. Okay, a number of other things. I don't have time to talk through all these, but lots of these. In total, tax expenditures reduce revenues by about $1.3 trillion a year. Remember, the total revenue we collect was about $2.4 trillion. This is $1.3 trillion we don't collect because of all these tax breaks. We'd have half again as much revenue, more than closing our budget deficit. Who benefits from all these tax expenditures? Very quickly, what I've done here is divided the world into four populations. The red is people in the top 0.1%. Those are the richest 1 in 1,000. The light color here is the rest of the top 20%, the top quintile. The light blue is the middle 60%, and the dark is the bottom 20%. Capital gains and dividends are taxed at a lower rate. Half the benefit goes to people in that top 0.1%, and fully 95% goes to people in the top quintile. Itemized deductions, most of that goes to people in the top quintile. Some of it's going to people at the bottom here, but a lot of it's this richest 20%. 75% of it is supposed to the richest 20%. Exclusions from AGI. These are the exclusions that we had. Again, well over half, 60% going to the top 20%. These are things that are not included in income, above the line. Again, more than half go to people at the top. When we get out to credits, we start moving down the distribution. Here, 80% of the non-refundable credits and 95% of refundable credits go to people in the bottom 80%, and of refundable credits, about 30% goes to people in the bottom quintile. Difference between refundable credits and non-refundable credits: a non-refundable credit can only offset positive taxes. It can bring your tax down to zero, but it can't pay you any money. A refundable credit says, once we've zeroed out extra taxes, if there's anything left, we'll send you a check for the difference. The refundable credits not only zero people's taxes out, but they give them cash payments. That's why we had that negative income tax rate that we saw earlier. But notice, depending on which kind of distribution you've got here, tax expenditure, it affects different people throughout the income distribution. If we look at all tax expenditures, though, 15 to 20% go to people in that top 0.1%, and over 60% go to people in the top quintile. So these are very unequally distributed in terms of who benefits from tax expenditures. Going after these tax expenditures, reducing them, increasing our revenues, would target people at the top end of the distribution, those most able to pick. Okay, I'm going to talk about the fiscal cliff, or actually fiscal cliffs, because there are more than one of them. Let's talk about the first fiscal cliff, the one we passed over. January 1st, we were supposed to hit actually a fiscal cliff that included tax increases. I was supposed to include the sequester, which we're all hearing about these days, cutting domestic and defense spending. And we were also about to hit our debt ceiling. Congress actually allowed one of these things to happen. Some of the tax increases occurred, but they pushed off the sequesters until tomorrow. Maybe they'll happen tomorrow. They will happen tomorrow. We'll start cutting domestic spending, start cutting defense spending tomorrow, but things won't hit very quickly. They'll build up over time. The federal government will start laying off workers or furloughing workers in April, just in time in the IRS case to not be there to collect your tax return. They're still due, by the way, on April 15th. You know, get any break for that. The federal debt ceiling, they pushed off till May 18th, and they can probably push it further than that if necessary. And then there's one more fiscal cliff in the middle there. The government funding has expired. Congress only funded the government this year up through March 27th. They have to fund it again if we want to keep the government in business after that. A little more discussion on this. What happened to the tax increases? There were a few things that happened. One was the expiration of the temporary payroll tax cut. For the last 2 years, we had a 2% reduction in the payroll tax financing Social Security. Took the tax rate from 6.2% on workers' earnings down to 4.2%, so that disappeared. That tax cut had saved households an average of about $900 a year. With the expiration of that, that's $900 a year pulled out of people's pockets. In aggregate, about $120 billion pulled out of the economy this year relative to what was there last year. Expiration of the 2001-2010 tax cuts, but only for high-income people. We extended those tax cuts for everybody except the top. It was going to be 2% if President Obama had his way, but when they finally settled on it, it became the top 0.7%. So we raised taxes on 0.7% of the population by not allowing the Bush tax cuts and the Obama tax cuts to continue for them. And we have some new taxes that took place, that started up this year to finance the healthcare reform that was passed in 2010. Those taxes hit only high-income people. In order to get hit by that, you have to be a couple with more than $200,000 of income, a single person with more than $200,000. That's the top 2% of the income distribution. What would have happened if we'd gone over the cliff? Well, there's the big bottom line, $536 billion of tax increases, $500 billion pulled out of the economy. That's about 3% of GDP. That, by CBO's calculation, would have reduced economic growth by about 3%, 3.5% over the course of the year, if it had lasted through the whole year. Our economy has been recovering very weakly from the depression, the recession we've been in. This would have reversed that. We would have gone into a new recession, but we didn't quite get there. Instead, our expiring tax cuts, payroll tax, pulled $115 billion out. This is what would have happened if we'd allowed the other tax cuts to increase, and we'll get about $24 billion in the new tax year law. See what the distribution actually was of, this is what would have happened if we'd gone over the cliff. Again, I've got the five quintiles down here at the bottom. Their taxes would have gone up anywhere from $400 to $14,000 on average for those five quintiles. On this vertical axis, though, I'm measuring income as a share, taxes as a share of income, so what's the effective tax rate? This would have raised the tax rate on the bottom four quintiles by about 4 percentage points, and it's 4% of their income would have gone to pay additional tax. For this top quintile, it would have been closer to 6%, and here I've got the top 1%. They would have been hit by an average of $120,000 tax increase, about a 7% increase in their the amount of income going to be taxed. What actually happened? A lot less. About a third as much for these bottom quintiles. For them, it's all the payroll tax. At the top, about two-thirds of the tax increase occurred. Part of that's because we allowed tax rates on the highest incomes to increase. Part of that is because the new health care taxes took effect for high-income people. But we get a lot smaller tax increases than we would have gotten. And note, even these rich guys that did get a tax increase got a lot smaller tax increase than they would have gotten had we allowed tax law to play out as it was scheduled to play out. This is just another cut on the same thing, but now I've got the basic tax rates that they're paying. The dark blue is the tax rates they're paying before the increase. The blue, light blue is what would have happened to those tax rates. The red is what actually happened. So relative to their tax rates, the biggest increases are down here. Their tax rate went from 1.6% up to about 1.7% total, a 1.1% increase. Here at the top, it went from about 31% to about 35%. Second fiscal cliff is the one that's going to hit tomorrow, sequesters, cutting domestic and defense spending. That'll cut spending about $85 billion this year, about $1 trillion over 10 years, and in addition to that $1 trillion, about $200 billion in debt service, interest paid on the national debt that would not be paid because we're not spending that money. It's only in discretionary spending that it protects all the mandatory spending, all the programs that are just built into law and go on year after year without any congressional intervention. Discretionary programs, Congress has to renew every year, every couple of years, saying you're allowed to spend this money. Virtually all defense spending is discretionary. The things that are mandatory spending are primarily Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the big transfer program. And it's split between defense and non-defense, big cuts in both. The D.C. area is very, very worried about this because we're so heavily dependent on defense. In Fairfax County, where we live, there are a lot of defense contractors who are laying off workers or giving workers warning that they may be laid off very shortly because of the sequester. So a lot of things are happening, whether or not the sequester occurs and whether or not the sequester lasts. In April, there'll be a lot of federal workers being furloughed, being told to take a day a week off or a day every couple of weeks off. It's expected that will reduce their incomes by about 5% over the course of the year, and that will have a hit on the economy. CBO estimates that the sequester, if it lasts through the year, will reduce economic growth by about 1.5%. Third fiscal cliff, the government funding expires. Congress has not passed a budget for fiscal 2013. That's the fiscal year that started last October. We're almost halfway through the year. Congress, instead of passing a new budget saying, here's what you can spend, said instead, well, you can continue spending like you used to spend, but only through March 27th. March 27th, we'll think about it again. And if they don't do anything, the government will shut down. The government did shut down a few years ago. It had a very personal effect on us. We had tickets to go see an exhibit at the National Art Gallery. And because the government was shut, our tickets were worthless, and we didn't get to see, what was it, Van Gogh that we were going to see? Van Gogh's it, yeah. So it is, you know, it gets personal every once in a while. The final one is one coming up in May. It's estimated to be May 18th. It's a guess about when the federal debt ceiling will be hit. Congress sets a limit on how much the government can borrow, how big debt can be. So when we get close to that limit, either Congress has to raise it or the government has to say, we can't borrow any more money. We can't, and we can't borrow more money, we can't pay our bills. There was a January agreement to allow debt ceiling to rise with the amount of additional spending, but only through May 18th. After that, they have to decide what's going to happen. Well, the ceiling will be there, but it won't bind, actually constrain the government's activities until sometime in August. But if they actually get to that point, the government will stop paying some of the bills it's supposed to pay. So we've got a bunch of fiscal cliffs in front of us, not just the one that we had in January. And you can bet that each of these fiscal cliffs will get kicked down the road a little bit. Although, we're going to go over one tomorrow. There will be a sequester starting tomorrow, and the question is how long they allow it to continue and how bad it will be for the economy. Okay, last and foremost, not foremost, last and most fun, 47%. 47% got a lot of publicity during the campaign when Mitt Romney said he didn't care about the 47% because they're people who don't have any stake in the economy. Where does 47% come from? Here's a brief history of it. Back in June 2009, I published a one-page paper, that's the whole paper right there, saying how many people don't pay federal income taxes. And this wonderful table down here has lots and lots of numbers in it, but the key number down here is 46.9, 47% of people overall, all tax units, all incomes, didn't pay federal income tax in 2009, best guess at the time. Nobody cared about this. Nothing happened with this piece of paper. It sat in Tax Notes, a very obscure journal in Daily, comes out five times a week in D.C. It's read by tax lawyers and a few tax aficionados, people who are willing to wear a tax tie sometimes. Nobody else reads it. But the following tax season, an AP reporter located this thing and put something out on the AP wire saying 47% of Americans don't pay federal income tax. So what happened next? Well, it became a little viral on the cable news networks, and in fact, I was invited to be on, I think it was a Fox. And the statement by one of the announcers was, 47% of all U.S. taxes named pay not one dime in taxes. Well, it's not true that it's not one dime in taxes. I'll tell you the whole story momentarily. But what do you do? What is the real story? Well, who does it take to get it right? Jon Stewart. I didn't get on the Jon Stewart show, on the Daily Show, but my paper did. 3 seconds of fame. There it is. Proof. So what is the story? Well, I'm going to tell you the story in three different pieces. It's one of the real good things that happened to this. Anytime I want to go to the Daily Show, I just call them up and they'll give me tickets. Well, I haven't gotten to New York yet, but my daughter got to New York. And she shows up and they invite her inside to the green room. And she's back there sitting in the green room as the various actors come back and forth. Boy, what a deal. All it takes is one paper and an obscure journal, somebody picking it up. I'm crazy on the end. So what's the real story? recession and the stimulus measure really made a difference in how many people didn't pay any income tax. Here's the percentage of people who didn't pay income tax starting in 2004 running up through 2013. And you'll see, before the recession, it was 40, drifting down 39%. Here comes recession year 2008, and suddenly it jumps to 50%. Why is it 50%? Well, a couple of reasons. People lost their jobs. They had less income. If your income's low enough, you don't pay federal income tax. So a lot of people didn't pay federal income tax because of that. But in addition, George W. Bush gave a big tax stimulus payments to people, $600 per adult, $300 per kid. That zeroed out taxes for a lot of people who were previously paying taxes. So suddenly we jumped from 40%, 39%, to 50%. And the next year, 2009, we've got the same thing happening again. The economy's a little bit worse, and President Obama's tax stimulus is putting money in people's pockets. What happens after that? Well, the economy starts getting better, just downward. And then in 2011, things go down a lot because the stimulus stopped putting money into your income tax, giving you an income tax break, and instead became a payroll tax cut. These aren't payroll taxes, these are income taxes. So suddenly those people who were not paying income tax because of the stimulus bills cut in income tax are now getting a payroll tax cut, but they're now paying income tax, and we're down to 42%. And as the economy's gotten better, we're down to 40%. And if we look out over time, we're going to continue to drop, and by the end of the decade, we'll be down to 31% of people not paying federal income tax. That's a lot different from half of the people, or 47%. So whoever runs for president in 2020 is going to say, I don't care about that 32% of people who aren't paying federal. That doesn't have nearly the 47%, even with these video cameras, with the cell phone cameras. Okay, secondly, almost everybody pays some federal taxes. We're only looking at income taxes here. Overall, in 2013, our estimate is 60% of people will pay income tax, about 40% won't pay income tax, but of that 40%, two-thirds of them are going to pay payroll taxes because they're working. And some money is going to be taken out of their paychecks for payroll taxes. If we look at the same graph we had before of people not paying income taxes, these are the people who are not paying payroll taxes. But they are all these blue here are people not paying income taxes, but they're paying payroll taxes. So if you're blue, you're paying payroll taxes. You're red, you don't pay payroll taxes. Two-thirds of the people not paying income taxes are paying payroll taxes. Only one-third of them aren't paying either one. Okay, how about those that are not paying either the payroll tax or the income tax? Well, about two-thirds of them are elderly, people who are relying on Social Security and pensions. They're not working, so they're not paying payroll taxes. Their incomes are low because they don't make very much money. They're not paying taxes. Another 3.5% are non-elderly people who don't have jobs and their incomes are below $20,000. They just don't make very much money. They're not paying tax because they're poor. We're left with 0.7% of people who are not working and therefore not paying payroll tax, not elderly, and making more than $20,000. That's a lot smaller number than 47%. Interesting thing is, though, there are people in that income category who have very high incomes. In 2009, there were 1,400 people with incomes of $1 million or more who didn't pay any federal income tax for one reason or another. So it's not that there are rich people not paying income tax. And I could spend all night telling you about the alternative minimum tax, which was Congress's way of going after high-income people who didn't pay income tax. Congress imposed the AMT back in the 60s because the Treasury Secretary reported to Congress that there were 155 people with incomes over $200,000 who didn't pay any federal income tax in 1967. And Congress said, oh my God, we've got to change this, and they imposed a new tax, an alternative minimum tax on everybody. Yeah? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I honestly don't know. I don't know. A lot of it was because they had income from overseas, and that was not, well, some of it's taxable here, some of it isn't. A lot of it had to do with the fact that we're getting foreign tax credits, credits for taxes paid overseas but not paid to the United States. They don't have to pay those taxes. Part of it is they gave away a lot of money because they could deduct the charitable contributions. A lot of things fit into it, but I can't tell you very much about those individual pieces. Thank you for the question. I'm glad somebody asked a question. Finally, I get a chance to wait a moment while you ask. Okay. Finally, almost everybody pays other taxes. Federal excise taxes, those are the taxes you pay on tobacco, alcohol, airline tickets, bows and arrows. You buy a bow and arrow recently? State and local taxes. The taxes we pay to our state government on local sales taxes. Every time you go down the store, you buy something, you pay, what is it here in Pennsylvania, 6%, 7%, 12%, 6%. We just raised ours so we could get rid of our gas tax in Virginia. That's a whole other story. We're not going to have a gas tax in Virginia anymore. We're going to have a more regressive sales tax. State income taxes. People pay state income taxes. People pay property taxes, either directly or indirectly. All these kinds of taxes. Almost everybody pays some tax. So even if you're not paying those other federal taxes, you're still paying something. And finally, income tax does two different things. As I said before, it raises revenue and it delivers social policy. I'm going to take the same, now I've got my pie chart, but I'm going to stretch it out into a bar. And eventually I'm going to fill in this whole thing. I've got incomes down the side. But here, this is everybody. And about, here we've got 60% of the population taxable, 40% paying no tax. Of that 40% pays no tax, half of them pay no tax because they have low income, and half of them because of tax breaks, those tax expenditures. The tax with low income, the standard deduction and personal exemptions alone zero out their taxable income. They have no taxable income after you've taken off the most basic things we say you shouldn't pay tax. That's half of the people not paying taxes. They're just too darn poor. The others are getting these tax preferences, the exclusions, the itemized deductions, the tax credits, all the different bells and whistles, the tax loopholes, the tax breaks, the tax preferences, the tax expenditures that zero out their taxes. This stretches out to the whole thing. The blue is people who are paying tax. The red is people who are not paying tax because they're poor. The green is people who are not paying tax because of the tax breaks. We're starting at the bottom here with people earning less than $10,000. Almost all of them are paying no tax because their incomes are so low. $10,000 to $20,000, you're getting quite a few people paying tax now, but more of them not paying tax are because of the tax breaks. As we work our way up, the income, low income, disappears. The tax breaks get smaller and smaller, and by the time you get up to the top, over $100,000, you've got 97, 98% of people paying income taxes. So it differs a lot across the income distribution. Again, poor people don't pay taxes because they're poor. But a lot of people don't pay taxes because it's green, all these tax breaks we've got. This just breaks out the kinds of tax breaks that there are. About 44% of all these tax preferences, that's the stuff that's green in this, all these green pieces, I'm breaking the green up now into types. Of that green, about 44% of it is breaks for the elderly. We don't tax the Social Security they get, don't tax all the Social Security you get. The elderly people get an extra deduction, a bigger deduction. There are things that the elderly get that the rest of us don't. About 30% is credits for children and poor and working poor. And the remaining quarter is all these bits and pieces, exclusions of transfers, itemized deductions, education credits, these things that you guys, your parents, look at, and so forth. So most of it, 75% of it, is for families with kids, poor families, and the old. Yeah? This is the percentage of the value of tax expenditures that's created by the different kinds of provisions. So 44% of all the tax reductions because of these tax expenditures are because of the ones for the elderly. Another almost third thinks of the benefits for the poor and families with kids. And just to make it even more complicated, there's the whole thing broken out by types of things, types of things. I'm not going to try to explain that one. If you want it, it's in a paper that we wrote. There are two things we can do on that. One is, I'm going to do two sides. I'm going to do one on the funding side, I'm going to do one on the spending side. On the funding side, charge people like me more. I'm pretty well off. I should pay a larger share. I'm going to get a real bargain when I retire. Actually, I shouldn't say that. I'm on Medicare already. If I collect all the Medicare benefits that I could potentially get, I will have about $800,000 or $900,000 worth of benefits, and it will have cost me a couple hundred thousand dollars in taxes. That's crazy. Why should we be paying that much for healthcare for people who are able to cover their own costs, able to buy insurance on the market? We need a market that lets people buy insurance. We should allow that, but we don't need to subsidize very rich people. We need to subsidize poor people. They can't afford to buy health insurance. That's part of what Obamacare is going to do. That's part of what Medicare does. Medicaid backs it up. So make people who can pay more on the funding side. On the spending side, we've got to figure better ways to spend money more efficiently. And there are a couple of things you can do there. One is make us more accountable for the medical decisions we make. If I decide to go to a doctor, it ought to cost me something. Today, if I go to a doctor tomorrow, I pay zero. Because I've got Medicare, I've got actually two health insurance plans, and when you add them together, I walk in the doctor's office, I walk out, and they say, goodbye. I say, how much is the bill? And they say, goodbye. Nothing. What's the incentive for me not to go see the doctor? Other than the fact I don't like to go see doctors. There's virtually no incentive because I'm not sharing the cost. So we need to have an economic stake in the game for people making the decisions. And you've got to put the same economic stake in the game on providers by saying, you've got to provide the kind of care that is effective and does something rather than just doing a procedure because you're going to get paid for it. We've got to get a way to pay providers that will give them an incentive to provide the best kind of care available to keep you healthy, to keep everybody healthy, and not spend as much money doing so. We know it's better to keep people healthy than to wait until they get sick and treat them after they're sick. We just don't have a good way to do that. And we need to figure out a way to do that. Part of what Obamacare is all about is trying to move things in that direction, change the incentives. We're not there yet because we don't have all the things we need to do that. But that's something, I could spend another. Good summary of, and there's a lot more to it than that, right? There are all sorts of problems. If this were an easy problem, we would have solved it 10 years ago, 20 years ago. It's really hard, and I'm not sure we're close to solving it now. I could come back next year and give the same lecture again, but we'll do it all on Medicare. Okay, so where does this all leave us? This is my last slide. Tax policy was a major factor in the presidential election, believe it by the amount my phone was ringing, and in the deficit and fiscal cliff negotiations. It will continue to be. Revenues have to rise to cover our costs, even with spending cuts. There's no way that the American people will be happy with the degree of spending cuts we need to balance the budget with the revenues we're scheduled to get today. We need more money to pay for the things we want. One of the things we haven't decided as a country, one of the things that Congress hasn't decided, the President hasn't decided, and we as a population haven't decided, is how big we want government to be. And a lot of the argument right now is over bigger or smaller, we don't know what it's going to be. Once we decide how big we want government to be, how much we want government to do for us, then we know how much money we need to pay for that, and we know how much we have to go after in revenue. We don't know that, but we have to, almost certainly have to increase revenues to cover our costs, because cutting the amount we have to cut just isn't going to make it to balance. Yes? The problem with bonds is that's just borrowing, again. And we're doing that, we're already borrowing to pay for those wars, and selling bonds is, again, a form of borrowing. What we really need to do is start taxing people. You want to fight a war? Is it worth fighting? Do we want to fight it? Are we willing to pay for it? Raise our taxes, pay for it with taxes. Bonds are exactly what we did. We put it on a credit card. That's the same as selling bonds in some sense. So that's not really the way to go about it. The way to go about it is say, are you willing to put your money where your mouth is? Are you money where your guns are? Okay, tax expenditures are going to be part of the equation. They're on the chopping block. Yeah? Right. Yes. I've got a set of slides that I chopped out of this. And what you see, if you look at the history of the income tax in particular, it follows a scallop pattern. Taxes rise, and they hit a point, and Congress says, oh, that's too high, we'll cut taxes, and they cut them, and it comes down. And the tax rate and the taxes coming out of the... When taxes stay the same, as incomes grow, revenues rise. We leave tax rates in place. As our incomes grow in real terms, we move into higher and higher tax brackets, we pay more of our income, a higher share in taxes, revenues rise relative to the economy. So every once in a while, governments... I didn't see that woman. Yeah? I didn't see her then. So we get this spiraling effect. Congress steps in and brings things down. That's why we've kept this roughly steady over time. But we see a rise and fall year to year or decade to decade. Virtually every decade you see this scallop effect. Okay, let me finish so I make Amanda happy. Tax expenditure are going to be on the chopping block, but finally, I have no idea what's the outcome is going to be. Nobody has any idea what the outcome is going to be. I do know we're going to be very busy in Washington doing whatever it is we do when we get to fiscal cliffs. And taxes are going to be a big part of that. And I'm not going to have any problem being employed for the foreseeable future. Thank you.